Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 27, the 1919 Boston Police Strike. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to talk about the events leading up to the 1919 Boston Police Strike, the rioting and looting that took place in the absence of law and order, and the impact of the strike on Calvin Coolidge's political career. But first, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is May 8th, and on May 8th, 1765, Harvard students listen to a discourse on popish idolatry. As you might remember from our debut episode, colonial New England was not very friendly to the Catholic faith. This particular lecture, delivered in the Harvard Chapel, had sections on the idolatry of worshiping the Eucharist, the idolatry of worshiping saints and angels, the idolatry of worshiping pictures and images. Are you seeing a pattern yet? And it concluded with a plea that, may this seminary of learning, may the people, ministers, and churches of New England ever be preserved from popish and all other pernicious errors. The author, Jonathan Mayhew, was pastor of Boston's West Church, and certainly had his mind made up about Catholicism.
May 9th is a bizarre and grim anniversary. On that day in 1989, a 42-year-old postal worker named Alfred Hunter III appeared in court on charges that he'd assaulted his ex-wife Elvira. He was sentenced to 2 years of probation, and he doesn't seem to have taken it too well. That evening, Al went to Elvira's house and murdered her, shooting her 7 times with an AK-47 in front of their young son. He then drove to the Beverly Airport and held a flight instructor at gunpoint, forcing him to fuel up and start a Cessna. And that's where things begin to get weird. Al Hunter flew north first, over southern New Hampshire, then doubled back and made a lap around Boston, before going further south and buzzing the Plymouth Airport. Then he turned back north and zeroed in on Boston. As sports fans streamed out of Fenway Park after a home game, they were surprised by a low-flying plane. As it flew over the crowd, there was a popping noise, but nobody realized for a moment what was happening, until a man walking down Newbury Street noticed shell casings dropping near his feet. Hunter was strafing the city with his AK-47 out the window of his stolen Cessna. He flew to the South Boston Postal Annex and made repeated strafing runs past it, as a cameraman from WBZ News recorded the bizarre sight. He shot at and hit the observation deck on top of the Prudential Center, flew under the Tobin Bridge, and shot up a few cars in Lynn. Finally, as the plane began to run low on fuel, Hunter landed it at Logan Airport about 3 hours after he began shooting. The AK-47 was never recovered, but the cabin of the aircraft was full of spent shells. Hunter would eventually be convicted of murder and armed robbery. He's currently in custody of the Massachusetts Department of Correction. We'll have video of Al Hunter strafing the South Boston Postal Annex in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/028.
Wednesday is May 10th, and on May 10th, 1773, Parliament passed the Tea Act. It granted the East India Tea Company a monopoly on selling tea in North America. At the time, they had a huge surplus in their warehouses in England. Getting the monopoly allowed them to clear out their inventory, and it let Parliament ensure that there was tea on the American market at prices that could compete with the illegal tea that smugglers brought in. Cheap, legal tea meant that the colonists might buy it, and Parliament needed us to buy it because it carried a tax. The tax on tea was the last of the taxes imposed by the 1767 Townshend Act. Paying it would mean that the colonists accepted Parliament's right to tax them. But we know how that worked out. That December, Bostonians refused to allow East India tea to be unloaded, eventually throwing the tea into Boston Harbor.
The Massachusetts legislature passed one of the most Puritan laws in the history of Puritans on May 11th, 1659. As we found out way back in Episode 8, the Puritans felt that Christmas was the relic of a pagan tradition, distracting people from their devotion to the Christian God. This law banned Christmas from Massachusetts Bay Colony, along with some other practices that might distract colonists from their faith. For preventing disorders arising in several places within this jurisdiction, by reason of some still observing such festivals as were superstitiously kept in other countries, to the great dishonor of God and offense of others, it is therefore ordered by this court and the authority thereof that whosoever shall be found observing any such day as Christmas or the like, either by forbearing of labor, feasting, or any other way. Upon such accounts as aforesaid, every such person so offending shall pay for every such offense 5 shillings as a fine to the county. And, whereas not only at such times, but at several other times also, it is a custom too frequent in many places to expend time in unlawful games, as cards, dice, etc., it is therefore further ordered, and by this court declared, that, after publication hereof, whosoever shall be found in any place within this jurisdiction, playing at either cards or at dice, contrary to this order, shall pay as a fine to the county the sum of 5 shillings for every such offense.
Friday is May 12th. After the British evacuation, our old friend John Adams was feeling a little bit optimistic about the improved defenses of Boston in a letter to Abigail on May 12th, 1776. But he was frustrated about the pace. It gives me great pleasure to learn that our rulers are at last doing something toward the fortification of Boston, but I am inexpressibly chagrined to find that the enemy is fortifying on George's Island.
Editor's note, they were not.
I never shall be easy until they are completely driven out of that harbor and effectually prevented from ever getting in again. As you are a politician and now elected into an important office, that of Judges of the Tory Ladies, which will give you, naturally, an influence with your sex, I hope you will be instant, in season and out of season, in exhorting them to use their influence with the gentlemen, to fortify upon George's Island, Lovell's, Pettix, Long, or wherever else it is proper. Send down fire ships and rafts and burn to ashes those pirates. Our people, by their turpitude, have invited the enemy to come to Boston again, and I fear they will have the civility and politeness to accept the invitation.
On May 13, 1841, the Boston City Council voted to relax the strict quarantine measures that had been in place for almost a decade at that point. Up until that time, a resident physician had been appointed, whose duty it shall be to reside at Rainsford Island from the first day of June to the first day of October in each year, and at such other times as the mayor and aldermen may direct, to visit every vessel arriving liable to quarantine, to direct in what manner she shall be cleansed, what articles from her shall be landed, washed, buried, or destroyed, to direct the care and attendance of the sick for whom he shall prescribe according to his best skill. And, by the 6th section of the same ordinance, it is provided that a quarantine shall be had of all vessels, their officers and crews, passengers and cargoes, that come within the harbor of Boston, on board of which any person shall, or may have been sick, of any contagious, infectious, or malignant disease during the passage to Boston, or which are foul, or infected after their arrival, or which are from, or have brought their present cargo, or part thereof, from any port, or place, where any infectious, contagious, or malignant disease doth prevail, or recently hath prevailed. And by the 7th section of the aforesaid ordinance, it is provided that the quarantine before mentioned shall be had and performed at an anchorage ground near Rainsford Island, under the direction of the resident physician, and shall continue on every such vessel until the master shall receive a certificate from the resident physician that he may be discharged. In recent years, there have been fewer cases requiring quarantine, and the resident physician found little need to stay the season on Rainsford Island. After this act, ships would no longer be stopped in the outer harbor. Only if sick people were present on a ship upon arrival would the ship need to stop and consult with a physician. And in the meantime, the quarantine hospital on Rainsford Island would be open to the sick among the city's indigent population.
Finally, Sunday is May 14th. Next time you're enjoying a fluffernutter sandwich, consider a small piece that appeared in the Lynn Daily Evening Item on May 14th, 1920. It announced that 2 World War I veterans from Swampscott, H. Allen Durkee and Fred Mower, had entered into a partnership to manufacture a product called Marshmallow Fluff. They purchased the fluff recipe from a Somerville man who had invented it in 1917, but was unable to find buyers. Durkee and Mower sold the confection to restaurants, hotels, and to housewives door-to-door, charging $1 per gallon. A decade later, Durkee would write, "We started out with 1 barrel of sugar at 28 cents per pound, a few tin cans, 2 spoons, 1 secondhand Ford, and no customers, but plenty of prospects. Today, after a short span of only 10 years, we have, through the fine cooperation of the wholesale grocers, the largest distribution of marshmallow cream in New England, and no Ford. Today, Fluff is a beloved local treat. You can read more about the history of marshmallow fluff in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/028.
Battle in Boston streets. Cavalry charges with sabers and infantry with bayonets. Three men killed, many hurt. Gamblers, thugs, and thieves operate openly and commit crimes against women. Fierce fight in Scully Square. Public fiercely indignant. Women pursued by mobs. This is a sampling of just a few of the headlines that Americans woke up to on September 10, 1919, the day after 1,117 Boston police officers, 72% of the force, failed to report for duty. While this shocked the country, this was not a surprise to the governor, police commissioner, mayor, or anyone else who had been paying attention. To understand how the series of events leading to the police strike unfolded, you have to remind yourself of what was happening in the world at that time. 2 years earlier, in 1917, the Russian Empire collapsed, and within months, the Bolsheviks, led by Lenin, overthrew the provisional government and established the Russian Soviet Federative Socialist Republic. The American economy was in a shambles after World War I, and inflation was felt disproportionately by the Boston police. In 1918, the annual salary for patrolmen capped at $1,400 after 6 years of service, but officers had to buy their own uniforms and equipment, which cost over $200. Pay for new officers, $2 per day, had not risen since 1857. That's 60 years behind the market.
In the war years, inflation dramatically diminished the value of a police officer's salary. From 1913 to May 1919, the cost of living rose by 76%, while police wages rose by just 18%. In comparison, they were earning less than an unskilled steel worker, half as much as a carpenter or mechanic, and 50 cents a day less than a streetcar conductor. You can imagine the resentment and discontent that this must have caused. During this time, the labor movement was taking off. In 1919, one-fifth of the country's workers went on strike. Locally, textile workers in Lawrence walked out in protest of a 54-hour work week. Boston telephone operators interrupted much of New England's phone service on a strike, and Boston's elevated train workers walked off the job as well. In total, there were 396 strikes in Massachusetts alone. There was a widespread fear of communism and a labor-led revolution, and given those numbers, you can see why. In addition to low wages, the police had several other serious grievances. Officers worked 7 days and between 70 and 100 hours per week with no pay for time spent in court, and only one day off every other week. They were required to sleep in station houses kept in unsanitary conditions. Tensions were heightened as the dispute broke along ethnic, political, and class lines. By 1919, Boston was already a Democratic city, and the commissioner was appointed by the Republican governor, Calvin Coolidge. This is a notable difference from today's system, where the mayor of Boston appoints the commissioner for the Boston Police Department. At that time, Mayor Peters was in the difficult position of running a city protected by a police force that he had no control over. Police Commissioner Edwin Curtis was a conservative Yankee elite overseeing a predominantly Irish Catholic police force. As the conservatives do today, he resented the growing political power of immigrants and the Democrats they elected to office. He was of no mind to grant concessions to those he thought were upending social order.
When by June he had failed to address the officers' grievances, they began to consider unionization with support from the American Federation of Labor, a relatively moderate organization. A charter was granted in August. Massachusetts Attorney General Albert Pillsbury stated that the organized workman has taken us by the throat and has us at his mercy, and put forward legislation to make unionization illegal for public employees. The mayor was off the grid for a vacation in Maine, and the police commissioner asserted that police were state officers, not employees in the legal sense of the word. Nevertheless, they persisted. On August 15th, over 1,000 policemen gathered at a hall in the South End, where they engaged in spirited rhetoric that would have made our founding fathers proud. The overwhelming majority voted to unionize and join the AFL. With that, the issue was no longer about low wages and rat-infested barracks, but about the right to unionize. In response, Commissioner Curtis issued a general order forbidding police officers to join any organization, club, or body outside the department, making an exception only for patriotic organizations such as the American Legion. His administration argued that such a rule was based on the conflict of interest between police officers' duties and union membership. He stated, "It is, or should be, apparent to any thinking person that the police department of this or any other city cannot fulfill its duty to the entire public if its members are subject to the direction of an organization existing outside the department. If troubles and disturbances arise where the interests of this organization and the interests of other elements and classes in the community conflict, the situation immediately arises, which always arises when a man attempts to serve two masters. He must fail either in his duty as a policeman or in his obligation to the organization that controls him."
Commissioner Curtis refused to meet with the 8 members of the police union's committee. He suspended them and 11 others who held various union offices and scheduled trials to determine if they had violated his general order. Mayor Peters sought to play an intermediary role by appointing a citizens' committee to review the dispute about union representation. The group recommended that Curtis and the police agree to a police union without AFL ties and without the right to strike. Curtis, in turn, would recognize the police union, and the union would agree to remain independent and unaffiliated. They also recommended that no action be taken against the 19 men whom Curtis had suspended. 4 of Boston's 5 newspapers, as well as the Boston Chamber of Commerce, backed this compromise. Curtis, with the support of Governor Coolidge, rejected the committee's proposal. He proceeded with department trials of the 19 men, and on September 8th, found them guilty of union activity. Rather than dismiss them from the police force, he extended their suspensions. He later explained that he was giving them an opportunity to reconsider their actions and avoid discharges, which would have been irrevocable. The police union members responded that same day by voting 1,134-2 in favor of a strike and scheduled it to start at evening roll call the next day. Their stated grounds omitted wages and working conditions. The strike's rationale was to protest the commissioner's denial of their right to ally themselves with the AFL. In anticipation of the strike, one newspaper warned the police that their eventual defeat was guaranteed, that they would lose because behind Boston in this skirmish with Bolshevism stands Massachusetts, and behind Massachusetts stands America.
Accepting that the strike would happen, Mayor Peters requested that Governor Coolidge dispatch the State Guard. However, the police commissioner assured Coolidge that volunteers could fill in. Approximately 400 students, faculty, and alumni were recruited from Harvard. Imagine that. The police force is replaced by college students. Maybe not the best idea. At 5:45 p.m. on September 9th, 3/4 of Boston's police force went on strike. 1,117 out of 1,544 officers failed to report for work. Coolidge assigned 100 members of the state's Metropolitan Park Police Department to replace the striking officers, but 58 of them refused to participate. By 8 p.m., a crowd estimated at 10,000 gathered in Scully Square, then a destination for vaudeville theaters and other slightly less respectable pastimes. The looting began with a cigar store and quickly spread. The crowds reveled, including many displays of public gambling, until after 1 a.m. Finger-pointing began the next morning. Mayor Peters issued a press release saying he was not to blame, and he called out the State Guard. He used an emergency clause meant to take control of the police whenever tumult, riot, and violent disturbance happened within the city. Coolidge reacted by issuing a statement that as governor, the Guard would be under his control. Both claimed that they would be the one solely responsible for restoring order. 5,000 guardsmen were dispatched, taking the city from virtually no police force to extreme militarization in a matter of hours. At Scully Square, there were confrontations between the volunteer police and the crowd, resulting in several Harvard students being cornered. When the first troop of cavalry arrived, they had to intervene to rescue groups of volunteers. Several guardsmen were injured by thrown rocks, but eventually the arrival of live ammunition and swords restored order in Scully Square. Mobile units with machine guns set up outside the armory in Bay Village.
I did find mention of one woman among all these volunteers. Helen Corrin reportedly directed traffic in long white gloves and a feather boa after no man stepped up to relieve an exhausted volunteer. I think Mrs. Corrin and I would be good friends. Violence peaked the next evening, the night of September 10th, and businesses were better prepared. Some had boarded up, and others stayed open all night with armed guards. The guards were visible to discourage thieves from taking advantage of the strike. But the militia's inexperience at handling crowds resulted in dangerous attempts to assert control. In total, 5 residents were killed by the militia, 2 by civilians, and over 20 people were seriously injured. When Governor Coolidge called the strikers deserters and traitors on September 11th, a mass meeting of the police union responded. When we were honorably discharged from the United States Army, we were hailed as heroes and saviors of our country. We returned to our duties on the police force of Boston. Now, though only a few months have passed, we are denounced as deserters, as traitors to our city, and violators of our oath of office. The first men to raise the cry were those who have always been opposed to giving labor a living wage. It was taken up by the newspapers, who cared little for the real facts. You finally added your word of condemnation. Among us are men who have gone against spitting machine guns single-handed and captured them, and volunteering for the job. Among us are men who have ridden with dispatches through shell fire so dense that 4 men fell and only the 5th got through. Not one man of us ever disgraced the flag or his service. It is bitter to come home and be called deserters and traitors. We are the same men who were on the French front. Some of us fought in the Spanish War of 1898. Won't you tell the people of Massachusetts in which war you served? That evening, the Central Labor Union came very close to calling a general strike of its members in solidarity with the police force. However, they ultimately delayed the decision with the explanation that we are not to act in a manner that will give the prejudiced press and autocratic employers a chance to criticize us.
Mayor Peters feared a general strike and was eager to compromise. Governor Coolidge could afford to take a firmer stance, as ultimately he wouldn't have to lead the city through the turbulence of a labor walkout. When the police union asked that the officers be reinstated so they could protect the city while a new contract was negotiated, Coolidge made the statement that brought him national fame. There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime. Over the objections of Mayor Peters, Commissioner Curtis announced on September 13th that he planned to recruit a new police force. He fired roughly 1,100 officers and hired over 1,500 replacements from a pool of unemployed World War I veterans. Members of the United Garment Workers refused to sew uniforms for the new hires, who had to report for work in civilian clothing. The new officers hired in the wake of the strike received higher salaries and more vacation days than the strikers had. They enjoyed a starting salary of $1,400, along with a pension plan, and the department covered the cost of their uniforms and equipment. Essentially, the new officers got everything the strikers had asked for. And so Boston found itself with a new police force resented by many, especially the city's Irish, who saw this as a pointed attack from the Yankee upper class. And due to the mass hiring, the entire police force was untrained. It would take years for the department to recover. Meanwhile, Calvin Coolidge emerged a hero. The middle and upper classes, terrified by radicalism and the threat of communism, saw his actions as a patriotic defense of democracy. Within 2 years, he would be elected Vice President of the United States. If you want to learn more, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/028. We'll share an Amazon link to a book on the strike called A City in Terror, Calvin Coolidge and the 1919 Boston Police Strike, as well as a fictional account by Dennis Lehane called The Given Day. We'll also post several photos from the strike and a YouTube link to the Dropkick Murphys' We Got the Power, written about the police strike. We'll also link to some political cartoons about the strike.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We are at HubHistory on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, Be sure to hit the subscribe link so that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on iTunes, we would love it if you could write us a brief review. It's the best way to help other people find the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with a show on Wonder Woman's real-life origin story.